but also to show how we can come alongside them and support them in their ministry. They're always looking for volunteers to help disciple women, to give women parenting classes, and they do a lot of ultrasounds. So in Alabama, it's illegal to have an abortion before you have an ultrasound. Once you get the ultrasound, you're good to go. So they offer free ultrasounds there at Wiregrass Hope, and then they obviously show the images to the mother and try to, you know, encourage them, but keep the baby, you know, and we can help you. We can help you enroll in college and everything else. So really neat ministry geared on saving lives, and we should be about that as well. So she's going to speak that day instead of myself. And then also November 14th, the leadership team is going to meet from 2:30, probably from 2:30 to 3:30 or something after Oneg. But did I miss any other announcements? I think I got them all. I just copy and paste Joanne's email. So if you guys don't get Joanne's email, it comes once a week. She sends out a great email with all the events and everything. Write down your email address and your name and give it to Joanne. Joanne, can you wave your hand for people who are visiting? If you just want to know what's going on, special events here at our congregation, subscribe to our email, and that will come out once a week. So let me get my music stand over here. Well, for those who are unfamiliar with what we do here and how we study and how we study the Word of God, we follow the oldest, most longest running community Bible reading program there is. Joel Osteen says okay, but we ours is better. Ours is the one Messiah followed, and it goes back to the times of Ezra and Nehemiah. And what we do is we take the first five books of the Bible. Well, we didn't, but it's already been done. The first five books of the Bible are divided into weekly sections called parshas, or parshiot in Hebrew, portions. And the goal is to get you to read each of these portions throughout the week so that you come to our Shabbat gathering and you're ready to discuss and learn about each of these portions. There's 54 weeks in a biblical year. That's why there's 54 and not 52. But we just restarted this cycle. We read Genesis and studied Genesis last week. This week we're studying the story right after that, which is Noah. And these different Torah portions, they get their name from the first couple words in each of those Torah portions. So this one's all about Noah, and it starts off with Noah. It's found in Genesis 6, starting in verse 9. And this is the year, I have this year here, this is the year 5781. That's how many years it's been since the creation of Adam. So we follow that biblical yearly cycle as well. This is an outline of this week's Torah portion. If I attempted to teach on everything in this Torah portion, we'd be here for a long time. There is a lot packed in this Torah portion. And last year, and the year before that, I taught on the flood of Noah. We're not going to teach on that this year. We're not going to really look at that. Although Megan Yates puts out teachings. Where is she? Oh, there she is. She puts out teachings on YouTube. It's called Devar Torah with Megan, right? So look it up on YouTube, and she talked about Noah's flood this week. So it's 5 minutes. I also posted it on our Facebook page. So check those out. And it really is good for if you have kids or anything, too. It really holds their attention. She does a good job of kind of distilling the Torah portion down and then bringing out a principle out of it as well and applying it to us. But Genesis 6:1 starts off the wickedness of humanity. Then Noah pleases God. Then the great flood happens. The flood subsides. And if you want to do a fascinating study, go read Genesis 1 and 2 and then compare the different parallels between the recreation of the world here after the floodwaters are receding. It follows the creation story exactly. So dry land emerges, there's vegetation, animals come out, so on and so forth. But it's a fascinating study if you want to get into that. But it parallels creation. He's recreating the earth, in other words, but with the difference being he has eight people in a teva, in a boat. And he's going to repopulate the earth with those eight people. Then he makes a covenant, a promise to Noah. And Noah is kind of a play on words because it says at the beginning of this Torah portion, Noah found this stuff called grace or favor in the sight of God. It's a play on words if you to read it in Hebrew. It's Noah. Noah is spelled Nun Chet in Hebrew. Grace is spelled Chet Nun. It's backwards. It's flipped. So it's a play on words. So in Noah's name is the idea of grace. God has always been a God of grace. And then we talk about Noah and his sons. That's a big dysfunctional story there that you could hopefully not relate with. And then Genesis 10, the nations descended from Noah. This is what we call the Table of Nations. And then Genesis 11, we finally get to this Tower of Babel story. And then Genesis 11 and 11 keeps going and talking about the descendants of Shem and Terah. But that's what we're going to zoom in on today, is the Tower of Babel. So if you're here to get a teaching on Noah's flood, I'm sorry, but you can look up that in prior years of the audio recording that I can share that with you. But let's go to Genesis 11. But before we jump into the teaching, I'm going to give you a quiz on what you know about this portion of the story, okay? True or false? The main reason the people of Babel decided to build a tower was to reach God in heaven. Ooh, you guys did better than I thought you would. They weren't trying to get to heaven? Yeah, you're right.
They wanted to make a name for themselves.
Thank you, Ian. Wow, Ian's on point with it. He wanted to make a name for themselves. Number two, what was the main building material used to build this city and the tower?
Clay bricks.
Yeah.
And all kinds of other.
Yeah, they made mortar, didn't they? And bricks. Good job. Number three, in the Bible, the cardinal direction of east is always a symbol of what? Yeah, which is what? Not Eden. Getting away, but what do we call moving away from God's presence? Exile. Anytime someone goes east in the Bible, look at Genesis 3. When they got kicked out of the garden, where did they go? Which direction?
East.
Yeah. All right. When the Babylonians came in and took the Jewish people captivity in 586 BC, where did they take them to? The east. Yeah. East is always, for some reason, it's a picture of exile. It's a symbol of exile in the Bible. Number four, who does Josephus say oversaw the building of the Tower of Babel? Josephus is a first century Jewish historian, preserved a lot of the early Jewish oral legends that were going on, kind of floating down. He put them on paper for us. But do you guys know who he said was kind of the foreman of the building of this tower?
Nimrod
oversaw the building of this city in general. Just kind of a rule of thumb too, a principle you can use for your study in the Bible, anytime someone either goes to or builds a city, bad things are about to happen in the Bible. Anytime someone builds or goes to a city, bad things happen. Okay, number five, Dina and Shechem, that whole story? Ooh. Number five, what are the dual meanings of Babel? Does anyone know what Babel means?
Confusion,
yeah. So even to this day, when we say, oh, quit babbling, it's like you're talking in a way that I don't understand. Right? We've preserved that. But Babel actually means something else too. It means if I take ingredients that I need for a cake and I put them all in a bowl, I'm going to Babel them. I'm going to mix them. Interesting. It's the idea of confusing. So now I can't decipher which ingredient is which. They've been mixed up thoroughly. That's the picture there, the physical picture we're supposed to see when we hear the word Babel. So that's the name of the city, is Babel. Isn't that interesting? It's the city of mixture. It's a city of confusion. Kind of sounds familiar. And that's what cities are. Cities are a mixture, right? They're kind of an assortment of people, assortment of ideas. Sometimes those ideas create tension and conflict in them, don't they? So let's go through four vocabulary words as well, and then we're going to weave those into the reading for this week. Safa is the first one you hear. Shin, pe, and he. Safa. Safa. So can someone go to Genesis 22:17, and then someone else go to Genesis, someone on this side of the room go to 22:17, someone on this side of the room go to 41:17. Let's see how this word safa is used. Let me tell you how it's used in this parasha first. In this parasha, safa is your mouth or your lips. Your mouth. Safa. You got it? Yeah, go ahead, read.
I will most certainly bless you, and I will most certainly increase your descendants to as many as there are stars in the sky or grains of sand on the seashore. Your descendants will possess the cities of their enemies. And by your descendants, all the nations of the earth will be blessed because you obeyed my order.
So that word seashore there is safak. Isn't that weird? In this parsha, it's translated as your mouth or your lips. But there, safa is used to describe the seashore. So who's got 41:17? Go ahead.
So Pharaoh said to Joseph, in my dream, there I was, standing by the bank of the Nile.
the word bank of the Nile, that bank, the shore of the Nile, is Safa. So what do your lips and the seashore and the bank of the Nile, what do they all have in common, you think? Huh?
Sound?
Yeah, stuff flows out of it. Sometimes that stuff can be life-giving. Sometimes it can overflow its banks, right? It's very dangerous to live near the seashore. It's very dangerous to live right next to a river. It's unpredictable, right? Sometimes our mouths are the same way, at least mine is. Sometimes things come out of my mouth, I'm like, why did I just say that? It overflows its banks sometimes. It can bring life or it can bring great chaos and death. All right, the next word, kedem. Kedem also has two meanings, like a lot of Hebrew words do. Kedem, we said it in our liturgy. We said, as we're putting the scroll away, kedem, bring us back as of old. That's what kedem means in this context, is from ancient times. So if you're from kedem, it means you're from the ancient times. But also kedem means east. Why would kedem be ancient and east, where the sun rises? Think of something like a concept of time. Yeah?
Jerusalem's kind of ancient and yeah. It's in
the east. Yeah, unless you live in Hong Kong.
That's what I have. It doesn't have a meaning of forward.
Kedem is always beforehand, before. Like, yeah, kedem, so when you're talking, like I'm talking to Todd last night around the dinner table, and if I told him, oh, kedem, before, like earlier today, like when the sun was coming up, you know, it's the idea of the sun was back that direction, but now it's over here. It's kedem. So we use kedem, we broaden the understanding to be from ancient times. It was long before, okay? We're gonna see that in this week's Torah portion. And then ear means two things as well. It could mean a city, like you have ear Dothan, the city of Dothan, but it could also mean excitement. Isn't a city exciting sometimes? Sometimes in a good way, sometimes in a bad way. You've been in New York. I love going to New York City, especially Manhattan. And whenever I have a layover at JFK, like 10 hours or more, I always jump on the subway. It gives me about $5 I can get to Midtown Manhattan. And I love coming up out of the subway and walking up, and then suddenly you're surrounded by this concrete jungle. And there's just excitement, there's smells, there's people everywhere taking photos. And I love doing that. But after about 3 hours, I'm done. I cannot do New York City anymore. I just can't. But I love going there for about 3 hours. It's a lot of work to get there for 3 hours. But that's what a city is. It's a place of excitement, right? And if you go with me to Uganda in Iganga, there's no streetlights anywhere, and there's like 5,000 people on motorcycles at night driving by as you're walking on the side of the road. And it's exciting, let me tell you. Yeah. It's terrifying. Yeah, people are driving very fast. There's music and vendors and all kinds of stuff going in the streets. All right. The last word that we're going to learn here today is migdal. A migdal, we read it, we actually sang it in our song. Migdal, a migdal is a tower. It comes from the root word gadal, and we said that also in the liturgy. Yit gadal, v'yit gadash, the kaddish. May your name be great. So a migdal could be understood as a point of greatness, the epicenter of greatness. Does that make sense? Migdal, a tower, but also the epicenter, the capital of our greatness, is how you could translate that as well. Whenever you put a mem in front of a word like that, in front of a noun, it denotes a place of that, okay? So let's read a little bit. What I did, I want to go through these verses kind of slow and read them in the original language, if you will allow me, because there's so much packed into this original language that we can kind of decipher. But follow along in your English, because I'm in Genesis 11:1, okay? Vayehi ko ha'aretz, and the whole earth, sefa. See that word sefa? It's mouth, it's lips, it's tongues. Et echat utavarim u echadim, and it's speech, it's mouth and it's speech were like one. They all spoke in unison, but also they all had the same language. It's a little bit different when you read it in Hebrew. They all had the same mouth, and they all had the same Devarim, words. And they were not echad, they were echadim. It adds, when you add, make a word plural like that, like echad, one, it's saying they were like ones. It's adding emphasis. They were very unified in their speech. Does that make sense? When you read it in Hebrew, it kind of like adds a little bit more weight to it. Here's verse 2. Vayehi Benasa'am Mikedem. And the people, and they came, they traveled from the east. Or you could also read it as they traveled from an ancient place. Veyam Si'u Beka'a Be'eretz. And they came to the land in the plain, Shinar. Shinar. Now, Shinar, there's the word for city right there. The Ein Resh is city, ear. Here is Shin. Does anyone know what Shin means? Shinar. It's teeth. Teeth. It could be translated as the city or the place of the teeth. Interesting. Vayeshvu, and they settled Sham there. Vayeshvu Sham, they settled there in the land, in the plain of the teeth. Interesting. And then Vayomru, and they all said, Ish el Re'e'u. They all said to each other. Every man said to one another, Hava, Hava, let's come on. Nil bena, let's build Liv Nim. What are we building here? Bricks. Now check this out. Look, the same word. Bena benim. Bena benim. To build and to have bricks is the same. The verb is the same as the noun. It's a kind of a play on words there. Brick, you use a brick to build. And you're building with bricks. And it says vanis refa. Now this right here, seraph, that root seraph, you've probably heard that before because there's these angelic beings called seraphim. They're the fiery angels, right? Well, what they're doing is they're taking these livnim, the bricks, and they're baking them in seraph, fire. Fire, it's like a furnace, right? They're hardening them. One time, the first time I was in Uganda, I was speaking at Beth Yeshua, and out front of the synagogue building, there was a big pile of bricks about 12 to 15 feet tall that were stacked up. And I was teaching on Exodus, and I wanted to bring one of those bricks in and use it as like an object lesson for all the kids there. There was about 20 or 30 kids in front of me. And I was holding this big, massive clay brick. And I was like, do you understand how hard it would be for the Israelites to make these all day long, every day? We just cannot relate to that. And one of the young men raised his hand. He says, brother, we, all of us made those bricks out there. Whoops, I cannot relate to that. But anyways, so lis refa, and they baked them, this uses the same word, it's redundant. And they baked them with fire and more fire, is how you could read that. Your translations probably say they baked them with fire thoroughly, or something along those lines. And it says, vatehi lahem halevna. And they decided to build le'evin with stone. Veha chamer, chamar is how you say it. It's like a with mortar. They said, let's make mortar. Haya lahem lechomer. And that's kind of a weird word because it's using the same chamar and chomer are the same word. That's why I'm tripping up on the vowels, because they're the same word, but they're different. It's like, let's make, some translations might say slime, some may say tar or pitch, but let's make some kind of mortar for our bricks to glue them together, okay? And it says, Vayamru Hava. They said, come on. They all said, come on. Nivne Lanu. Let's build Lanu for ourselves here, a city. Let's build a city. Umigdal, there's our word, Migdal, with a tower. Verosho, with its head, Beshamayim, up in heaven. Uh-oh. Here's, and many people stop there and they say, oh, they're trying to build a tower to heaven. They're trying to get to heaven, right? Maybe, but that's not the real cause. Here it is. Venasae lanu, and we will make, venaase lanu, we will make for ourselves, shem, a name. Pin, nafuts, otherwise, or we might be pootsed. We might be scattered. Al panei kol haaretz, over the whole face of the earth. Interesting. So what was their fear? What was their motivation? To make a name so that they wouldn't be scattered. So if we can make a name for ourselves, then we won't be scattered. Right? But they're already in disobedience because God said in Genesis 2, he said, go, Adam and Eve, fill the earth. Scatter all over the earth. Be fruitful, multiply. So here's what happens. Vayired, and comes down Adonai. Uh-oh. So interesting here. The irony hopefully isn't lost on you, that they're building a tower, hopefully to get to heaven, and God still comes down. Isn't that funny? He's like, oh, what is that? Oh, I need to go down and see what they're building. Good try. Lirot et ha'ir, and to look at the city, he said, the et ha'midah, and the tower, asher banu b'nei ha'adam, that they were building. They were building a tower for themselves, that the sons of Adam. Now that word Adam right there is very specific. It's dealing with humanity. All of humanity was united in this effort, is what he's saying. So let's extrapolate their goals. What were their goals for building this tower? They wanted to make a name for themselves. Yeah. What kind of a, I don't understand that. What does that mean, do you think, to make a name for yourself? Yeah.
To be famous.
To be famous. Yeah, pretty much. To be remembered, to be famous. What was their second goal?
To not be scattered.
To not be scattered. Yeah. Yeah.
To create a unified
like a one world government.
Yeah,
no, absolutely.
Which is exactly in all the Nimrod's.
Yeah.
Socialism does the same thing.
Yeah.
You can't force everyone into a mold.
Yep.
And bricks.
Exactly. Here, just come up here and take the click note. But no, absolutely. Absolutely.
In Latin, that word is
Illuminati.
Yeah.
Really? Oh, okay. You have it. Damn. So yeah, they wanted to make a name, and they didn't want to be scattered. They wanted to create a unified system of governance. Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is kind of like a primitive form of humanism when you think about it. They weren't really worshiping. They were acknowledging that there was a heaven, but they, here, let me go on a little bit further and talk, because we're going to answer that question. What issues did God, Hashem, have with their efforts? Yeah.
Well, them trying to make a name for themselves, they've taken glory away from God.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He's got a problem with that.
Yeah. He wants to make a name for himself. He wants us to make a name for himself. What else?
I want them to scatter so that I will take his name.
Yeah. He wants them to go out. Yeah. What else, though? Let's read a little bit. And we keep reading. If we keep reading English. If as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us, who's the us here? Let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. So the Lord scattered them. Wow. He scattered them from there over the face of the earth. That's the exact same thing they were trying to avoid, right? And they stopped building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because there the Lord Babeled the language of all the earth. And from there, the Lord dispersed them all over the face of the earth. The very thing they were trying to avoid, he did. It's interesting. So what was the end result? They get scattered. Their language is mixed up. But what did God not do? It's kind of glaringly obvious. Sometimes you don't see it unless you... What did he not do that I would have done? He didn't kill anybody. And he didn't knock the tower down. Like, if it was me, I'd be like, bink. You know, like a Jenga thing. But he didn't do that. Yeah, it's almost like he was mocking them. Like, I'm going to leave this tower here as a memorial of your confusion. If you try to do this again, I can confuse you again. What's interesting. Now, I'm going to read a little bit. I love Dennis Prager's book on Genesis right here, The Rational Bible. If you haven't picked this up, he should give me a kickback. I've been putting these commercials for him. But let me read a little bit on our quest for fame. I think Aurora did a good job of pinning this in the word fame. He says, nothing has changed regarding human nature. To this day, countries vie with one another to build the tallest building in the world for no other reason than to become the country that built the tallest building in the world. Or in other words, to make a name for ourselves, right? But having the tallest building in the world says nothing about your country other than it has the tallest building in the world. The Torah does not necessarily oppose making a name for oneself. Like in the very next chapter, God tells Abraham that he will make Abraham's name great. And the sin of the builders of Babel and of most people wanting to make a name for themselves is wanting to do so solely to make a name for themselves or to bring glory back on themselves. As God is not completely absent, they recognize nothing higher than themselves to bring glory to. As explained in the commentary on the Ten Commandments, which is early in the next book of his, the commandments prohibition against having false gods, this nothing higher issue is at the core of the problem of contemporary art, most of which is meaningless, and much of which is degrading. There is a whole genre of contemporary art that is scatological in nature. And he says, see the essay on the false gods in the commentary of Exodus 20. But he says, by contrast, nearly all great Western art was produced by artists whose art and or whose societies affirmed the existence of a god. As I note in the commentary to Exodus, I asked John Elliott Gardner, one of the greatest Bach conductors and the author of a major biography of Bach, if he thought there was a decline in the quality of classical music in the modern period, and if so, whether he would ascribe that decline in large measure to secularism with its absence of faith in God. To my surprise, he fully agreed. When there is nothing higher than man, most art is simply self-referential. Look at me. That's what the builders of the Tower of Babel cared about. The Babel story has been pertinent to every age and every generation. But it is particularly relevant today when so many people yearn, perhaps more than anything else, to be famous, to, in the Torah's words here, make a name for themselves. This yearning often starts at a very young age. I have asked young people for decades what they want to be when they grow up. And over the years, I found increasing numbers respond with famous. And it is not only young people. Many adults in the country I know best, America, ache to be famous, to appear on any public media, make even a non-speaking appearance in a movie, or see one's name in print on a screen is to stand out and to validate one's worth. Before explaining why the pursuit of fame is a bad idea, it's important to acknowledge once more the desire to make a name for oneself is not necessarily a bad thing. If a person wants to become known for achieving a worthwhile goal, that can be a spur to pursuing that goal. Also, as long as a person is focused on the worthwhile end of that goal, the fame that comes as a byproduct is well earned and will not distort the values or emotional stability of a balanced person. But if a person's primary goal is to be famous, fame becomes their false god. And like all false gods, it is dangerous. Because one of the characteristics of a false god is something that becomes higher than morality itself. Therefore, a person might do anything to become famous. For example, many experts believe a primary goal of young people who shoot their schoolmates is to have their, quote, 15 minutes of fame. Aside from theology and morality, there are other reasons why the pursuit of fame is pointless and often self-destructive. First, in almost every case, whatever fame a person achieves will die with him, if his fame even lasts that long. A medieval Jewish text called The Ways of the Righteous puts it this way. Think about how many proud men have vanished from the world and have been forgotten as if they never existed. There were many people who lived in, say, the 6th century who thought they were very important, but how many of them can you name? One doesn't have to go back to the 6th century. Take, for example, presidents of the United States. To the vast majority of Americans, let alone non-Americans, the names of these men, like Franklin Pierce, Rutherford, Hayes, Chester Arthur, just to cite three, they mean nothing. Yet to Americans living in those presidents' lifetimes, those individuals were the most famous people alive. Today, the large majority of even those familiar with these presidents' names probably can't specify a single accomplishment by any of them. This is true even in our own lifetimes. As we get older, we all come to the often unexpected and always sobering realization that almost every person who was a household name when we were younger is unknown to the next generation. We always say, like, I wonder what happened to them, right? We always say those things. As a Persian proverb puts it, after the game is over, the pawn and the king go back in the same box. I like that. Second, fame is fleeting for the vast majority of those who attain it. That is, it doesn't last until their death. Only a small minority of those who are famous at 30 will still be famous at 60. Third, When the person who pursues fame loses it, they often end up emotionally and psychologically depressed. The more you value fame, the more you lose your purpose for living when you lose that fame. Fourth, even if you do stay famous, if you have value fame, you will devote your life to keeping it. And little is more pathetic than watching a person devote their life to trying to stay famous. Fifth, unlike other things people desire, fame is available only to an extremely small number of people. So theoretically, very many people can be rich, healthy, or happy, but how many people can be famous? By definition, only an infinitesimally small number. There are, after all, only a limited number of names people can keep in their heads. In pursuing the goal of fame, one is almost inevitably pursuing an unattainable goal. Sixth, few things distort a person's thinking, values, and even personality as much as fame. The greater the fame, the greater the inclination to think one is better than others. The percentage of young people who become very famous and then become almost entirely different is quite high. Given the powerful appeal of fame, is there an antidote? In addition to realizing how pointless, fleeting, and self-destructive the pursuit of fame is, the most effective antidote is to take your faith seriously. The more important God becomes in your life, the less important you and fame become. A genuine and humble faith in God puts things into perspective like nothing else. Finally, and most important, we all need to remember this rule of life. The famous are rarely significant, and the significant are rarely famous. The caretaker of an invalid, for example, is the most significant person in that world to that invalid, but hardly famous. On the other hand, many movie stars are extremely famous, but barely significant. And the people who personally know them, love them, and regard them as significant do not do so because of their fame. Very few of us can or will be famous, but all of us can be significant. I was reading a story in Auschwitz about a woman delivering babies,
yes,
secretly. Mm-hmm. And we don't even know her name. Thousands of babies delivered. So the problem with the Tower of Babel is not only fame, but fame at the expense of other people was their quest. This is from the book of Jasher, chapter 9. Things that add some interesting details in the story. All the people and all the families divided themselves into three groups. The first said, "We will ascend into heaven and fight against him." The second said, "We will ascend into heaven and place our own gods there and serve them." The third group said, "We will ascend into heaven and kill him, smite him with bows and spears." And God knew all their works and all their evil thoughts, and he saw the city and the tower which they were building. And when they were building, they built themselves a great city and a very high and strong tower. And on account of its height, the mortar and the bricks did not reach the builders in their ascent to it until those who went up had completed a full year. And after that, they reached the builders and gave them the mortar and the bricks, and thus it was done daily. And behold, these who ascended and others descended the whole day. And if a brick should fall from their hands and get broken, they would all weep over it. "Oh, you broke a brick." And if a man fell and died, none of them would even look at him. So placing the value of the bricks over the value of humanity, right? Or here's one for you. Placing the value of your education over the value of the human life. Do we do that? Placing the value of a better future over the value of a human life. Pharaoh says this. Pharaoh was obsessed with bricks. "But require them to make the same number of bricks as before. Don't reduce the quota. They are lazy. That is why they are crying out. Let us go and sacrifice to our God. Make the work harder for the people so that they will keep working and pay no attention to their lives." See, Pharaoh loved people making bricks for him at the expense of other people, didn't he? But here we see it interesting. God is completely different from that. In Exodus 25, he says, pertaining to the altar, "If you make an altar of stones for me, do not build it with cut stones, with dressed stones, for you will defile that altar if you use a tool on it." Interesting. He sees things completely different. He wants things to be in their natural state, the way he created them. Deuteronomy 27:5 says the same thing. Moreover, you shall build there an altar to the Lord your God, an altar of stones. You must not use any iron tools on them, on my altar. So bricks in scripture represents our taking his creation and manipulating it to our benefit, right? And increasing our fame and our name in the land. In other words, we change its natural state. So I used to do this with musical talents. I took something he gave me and desired me, and I used it to make my name great. And then I had to take a break for several years, and now I use it to make his name great. But we do that. Sometimes we make bricks when he just wants us just to be a stone. Stones represent God's providence through his creation. How did he create you? What has he gifted you with, right? Which one was the temple made of, you think? A brick or a stone? See, don't confuse a stone with a brick, because a stone, you cut it out of an already existing stone. You don't make that from clay. Which one was the temple made of? Yeah. When the house or the temple was built, it was with stone prepared at the quarry, so that neither hammer nor axe nor any tool of iron was heard in the house while it was being built. They made it so far away, in other words, you could not hear that work going on. But humans love towers, don't we? We love to build these tall things.
Like the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, like the Eiffel Tower. Yeah, Adrian's got a fun story about the Eiffel Tower. But here's a couple towers that we built, right? These were the tallest buildings in the world at one point. But where are they now? Yeah, they're destroyed, sadly. And here's what we humans do, right? We in our audacity, in our arrogance almost, we're like, oh, they took our towers. Fine, here's what we'll do. We'll build a better one. Right? We'll build a better one. And in this tower, there are remnants of the original two towers. They have a museum in there memorial to the other two towers. But here's one, and we don't have the tallest tower. Shame on us. Right? No, Dubai does. The Burj Khalifa. And I had the pleasure of flying. I flew out of Dubai a couple of years back, and I'm telling you cannot fathom how tall this building is. Like, when you're flying by it, right by it in a jet, in a 747, have you ever flown out of Dubai? You've seen the Burj Khalifa? It's like people are looking down at you from that building, you know, as you're flying, you're taking off the airport, you're like, oh gosh, this is terrifying. But it's just enormous. It's unfathomable that the Burj Khalifa is. But building societies and building towers is kind of like our way of evolving. Right? If we think that evolution is true, that's how we think we're evolving. In all of our amazing wisdom, right? Sarcastically saying, okay, let's build a bigger tower. Right? Here's what Marx said. Karl Marx was obsessed with building the perfect societies. And he says that humanity must labor cooperatively in order to survive and free ourselves from the shackle of like these natural constraints. That's what Marx was obsessed with about. Work makes you free. It's kind of, does that sound familiar to anybody?
It was Auschwitz.
The entrance. Marx also said, you must labor to be free, and I will tell you where to work, how long to work, and what your wages will be. Does that sound like Pharaoh to you? That's what Marx says. Yeah. And hey, don't worry though, the goal is that we will all be free. The goal is that we'll all be equal. Right? Do you see the irony in that statement though? We all want to be free, we all want to be equal, but you're going to go by my rules. Right? Here's what the Lord says. I don't care where you work, as long as you give some of what you make and you take time off. Think about that. How different is that, right? Take time off to rest. See, humanity, like Karl Marx, always imposes stuff. Their will, their ideas. God doesn't do that. He invites, right? He's not going to force you into his presence. He's going to invite you into his presence. That's not what a loving God does. He doesn't impose. One of the tools used for imposition is our ability to communicate through speech. Like, I think it's St. Joseph Assisi. Assisi? Was he Assisi? He said, share the gospel with everyone, and when necessary, use words. In other words, I invite you to the gospel through my actions. I always say the best way to communicate truth is to live it humbly and be ready to give an answer as to why you do. Right? That's way better than posting things on social media. It's just live it, be ready to give a reason why you do. Live it humbly. But language is a divine gift given to us that can be used to edify or to tear down, right? Like the river, right? The Safa. We can use speech to bring death, or we can use our speech to bring life, right? So what is the most widely used language you think in the world? Any guesses?
Spanish.
Spanish?
English.
Mm. It's interesting because there's two different ways of looking at it. If you look at native speakers, Chinese Mandarin has it by a long stretch, the most widely used language in the world. Yeah, what? God bless you. So, Jim is happy about it because he speaks Chinese, but Chinese Mandarin. But if you look at native speakers and non-native speakers, English has it by a long stretch. Interesting. So the two greatest languages in the world right now are English and Chinese.
One interesting side note, the word for tower in Chinese is dirt, grass, and all the people are one tongue.
Weird. That's interesting. He said the word for tower in Chinese is dirt.
Grass. That's how you make bricks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All the people are of one tongue.
All the people are of one tongue. That's interesting. But check this out. This is, I was fascinated by this graph. This is book translations in the different languages of books. So if you take a book like, let's say, Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, and this is what it looks like, the distribution of that book in all these different languages. It's kind of scattered. It starts in English, and then it scatters out. It's pretty evenly distributed, right? Those are books. But look at this. This is internet usage. It's way more condensed, isn't it? With English being at the center. Isn't that interesting?
And when you travel, anywhere you go, they pretty much speak English.
Yeah.
Somebody.
But what it tells me is English is the language of the internet, and English is the language of commerce and trade. So there's 2 billion English speakers in the world right now that can speak English. Not native-born English speakers, but that can speak English. So what are the two greatest economies in the world? If I told you the greatest languages are Chinese Mandarin and English, what do you think are the greatest economies in the world?
China and the U.S.
China and the U.S. Yeah. So what influences those languages the most? What do you think? What influences language in general?
Culture?
Money and economics does. If you're going to learn, you're going to go through the hard work of learning a language because you have more opportunity ahead of you to do so, right? AKA money, wealth, right? In other words, making a name for yourself. You're going to learn a new language if it means more opportunity or possibly making a name for myself. So, but let's talk about China and the U.S. Which are the two greatest nations in a state of tug of war right now?
China
and the U.S. Yeah, because of the two biggest languages in the world.
We don't want to lose our name.
So did God ever interact with our language again after the Tower of Babel? Did he ever interact with humanity's language? Did he ever do anything to our language? Jim? Did he ever try to undo the Babel experience?
Yes.
Acts 2.
Yep.
Yeah. We see people begin to speak miraculously in each other's languages again. Right? But it wasn't like they went out and got Rosetta Stone and started learning that. It was that he supernaturally put that in their minds to be able to do it. Interesting. I had the president of my college, Dr. Mark Rutland, he prayed and fasted that if the Lord would give him a speech, be able to be fluent in a foreign language, he would go to that region of the world and be a missionary there. And he woke up the next morning, or whenever his fast was done, and he was completely fluent in Spanish. Never took a Spanish lesson in his entire life. And I've heard it multiple times. I've heard him speaking Spanish multiple times. But anyways, will he do it again in the future? You guys want to go to Zephaniah 3? Zephaniah 3. I believe that Acts 2 was just a small foretaste of what will happen in the future. Acts 2 is just a small foretaste of it. So go to Zephaniah 3, verses 9 through 12. See if you recognize any words when I read this in the original language. I'll give you guys a moment to get there. Take a swig of water. Okay. Zephaniah 3:9 says this in the original language. Ki az ehepok el amin. And he will purify the people, sefa and their lips. You recognize that word from the Tower of Babel? Sefa. He will purify their lips, their mouths. Berurar, he will make pure or perfect. Likra, to call, kulam, everyone. Beshim, on the shim. Where did we see the shim in the Tower of Babel story? We did, but whose shim were they calling on? Their own name, right? So he's purifying their safa so that they can call likra kulam bashim who? Adonai, the Lord, the God of heaven. Le'avdo shechem echad. So that they will all be one. Whoa. That's fascinating to me. So he's gonna purify our lips again so that we can all speak and call on him as one. Not like in the Tower of Babel, when we try to do it, but under the influence of his spirit. Proverbs 18:10 says, Migdal Oz Shem Adonai. It's a strong tower. Is the name of Adonai. Bo Yarutz Tzadik Vaniskav. And the righteous run into it. The righteous take refuge in it. When we finally grow tired of trying to force our way back into the Garden of Eden, when we finally grow tired of making bricks for Pharaoh, or finally grow tired of making bricks for Nimrod, he can redeem our efforts and use us to become the living stones of his temple. Let's go to 1 Peter 2, 4 through 6. 1 Peter 2, 4 through 6. Because we are not bricks, we are stones. Annie, do you have it? Did you read it? 1 Peter 2, 4 through 6. Beautiful. What he's saying there is, hey, if you stop trying to build your own tower, I will build you into a temple and you will not be put to shame. But if you try to build your own tower, I will put you to shame. Isn't that beautiful? The Gospel of Babel says this: salvation is achieved through our efforts. That's humanism. Salvation is achieved through our efforts, and that's pride, right? The Gospel of the Kingdom says this: salvation is achieved through surrender. That's humility. All these things my hand has made, says Isaiah. And so all these things came to be, declares the Lord. But this is the one to whom I will look on favorably. He who is humble and contrite in spirit and trembles at my word. So in closing, I'd like to leave you with a question. Are there any areas or habits in your life where you're attempting to force your way into his presence? Remember, they're trying to get up into heaven and force their way in. And what towers are you building in your life? Yeshua says, come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. For I am gentle, I am humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. My yoke is easy, unlike Pharaoh, unlike Nimrod. My yoke is easy, he says, and my burden is light. Let's pray. And we may have time for Q&A as Kish is going on. Avinu, Malchenu, our Father and our King, we thank you that you're a loving God. And you have shed your grace on us through the death and the burial and the resurrection of the Messiah. And I pray that if there's anyone in this room right now, and myself included, that is making towers to make their name great, that you would just put conviction upon us. And we would strive and exert all of our energies to instead making your name great. And I pray all these things in the name and the righteousness and the merit and authority of Yeshua. Amen. So as Kiddush is going out, if you guys have any questions or points you'd like to add, this is your moment.
Yeah. Yeah, I had something to add. So the biggest difference between every religion on earth and the way is that every religion on earth seeks salvation through works. Mm-hmm. In the way, it's a free gift.
Yeah.
It's already
yeah.
given to you. You just have to, you know, surrender, like you said.
Yeah, for those who couldn't hear or watching online, he says the thing that sets our faith apart from all other faiths in the world is that salvation is a gift. It's not earned by us. Just like the Israelites did nothing to earn their way other than putting the blood of the lamb on their doorposts, we cannot earn our salvation. That's every other faith is different than us in that way. Good point. Anything else?
Yes.
Yeah, Howard?
One thing we have to remember is works is not a bad thing.
Correct.
Most other people look at it in that aspect.
Yeah, I like to say we're saved by grace, rewarded by works. Rewarded based on our works. So once we're saved, that's just, we're like a baby, right? But we're rewarded based on our obedience and our works, okay? Saved as by grace, rewarded by works. But let's see, okay, Mr. Wayne. Absolutely. Anybody else? Questions, comments?